From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in 1999 when the former director of the Peace Corps became the head of Hobart and William Smith Colleges. Mark Guerin came to Geneva with powerful connections and big plans for HWS, and 18 years later, Guerin is leaving the post. He'll become president in residence at Harvard University. Guerin leaves after two decades of remarkable change at Hobart and William Smith. The colleges have risen in the college rankings. College staff have become intricately involved with the Geneva community. And this hour, we're broadcasting from our studio, WEOS in Geneva, the home of Finger Lakes Public Radio. It's our chance to sit down with President Guerin to talk about his tenure, the issues facing higher education, and more. It's nice to see you in person for a change.
Thank you, Evan. It's great to have you here in Geneva and to have Connections broadcast from here. Welcome.
We're going to get used to this. We're going to do this more often. And I have to start by asking you, what exactly is a president in residence? That's what you're going to be.
Well, I'm deeply honored by this appointment. It's at the Harvard's Graduate School of Education. So I'll be teaching, co-teaching doctoral students going into higher education, working with them, meeting with them informally. So for me, it gets me a chance to reflect on 18 years here, write a bit, and think about the issues challenging and the opportunities facing American higher education.
The issues and opportunities facing higher ed, what's at the top of that list for you?
For me, it would be access, the question of college access. And I think it's a defining issue for, as a matter of public policy, certainly individually for both public and private institutions. And an issue we've worked on very assiduously here at Hobart and William Smith.
We had a panel earlier this week of first-generation college students and really enjoyed our conversations with them. And there was a moment that stood out to me when one of the students who came from a, you know, a low-income family background talked about going through middle school, not really thinking about college. No one in the family had thought about college. Then it becomes maybe an opportunity. He's going throughout high school, but obviously, you know, like you and, you know, me at that age, probably doesn't know a whole lot about finance, how to pay for it. And what he started to look at was sticker prices. And one thing I hear a lot from Don Braveman and Bill Destler and Mark Guerin is, you know, very few people pay the full sticker price, and the sticker prices are pretty big. But this student who was never going to pay a full sticker price felt like, I can't even try. Look at those prices. And it had a psychological impact. So let's talk just a little bit about what access means in terms of cost. First of all, I know not everybody pays the full sticker price.
Right.
But are you concerned that the sticker prices are too high, or are we just not understanding the issue well enough?
Well, both. You know, I am concerned because the last thing you'd want is for talented students like the ones you met with, particularly first-generation students, but not exclusively, would look at the sticker price, as it were, and think that that is impossible for their family, or would leave them burdened with crushing debt. And the reality is, thanks to our donors and families and support of our Board of Trustees, virtually 8 out of 10 students at Hobart and William Smith today receive some form of aid. We're proud of that. We're proud of the advances we've made within our budget for financial aid. So I think it puts a premium on public education in terms of broadly public education, work with counselors and guidance counselors and career counselors in schools, so that they are aware that within so much a part of independent higher education, in which is a proud history in New York State. There are some of the finest independent schools in our region and elsewhere, as are the public schools. So for me, we would want the decisions to turn on students to match their interest, the fit for their college matriculation. And what's very clear in American higher education today is the great mosaic that exists. And higher education is the envy of the world. People travel from across the planet to come to our college and universities. And it is a different profile. We might have imagined leafy quads and traditional college age students from 18 to 22. And while that's...
You have leafy quads.
That is the case for here.
Yeah.
But when you look broadly at American higher education, students can be of a different age category, first generation, lower income students. So there is a broad array of really fine ways to get educated in America today. And that's the good news about higher education. How do we bend the price point and the cost for students? How do we ensure that they don't graduate with a debt that could mar or impair their career choices? We need to make sure at a place like Hobart and William Smith, as we're proud that we've done today, is that they'll be able to be public school teachers if they want, or social workers or ministers, or careers that have high impact that are truly lives of consequence that may not have the compensation and remunerative benefits of other professions. You'd hate to think, as a matter of public policy,
sure,
that those career choices are made, let alone home buying and car buying and starting families. All that gets threaded into this question of college costs, college debt. So it is a national discussion worth having, one that we've worked very hard, particularly on first-generation students, having a program, having faculty members assigned who they themselves, in many cases, were first-generation students. So they have a mentor to work with them during their 4 years here, because this, none of this is obvious. No one is born knowing the kind of pathways of what is an office hour, what are matriculation schedules, all of this. And so we want to provide those pathways that exist.
I don't want to be too reductive, but is there one concrete example of something that could change in your mind in the near future that would make higher ed much more accessible in this country? Is there a proposal that's out there? Is there a certain policy that some schools adopt that others don't? Is there something that could change?
I think the big question for our policymakers, both on the state and federal level, is the public investment in higher education. Do we certainly believe that the ladder of opportunity is essential in virtually every professional career with higher education? So what is our public commitment on the one hand? And to look introspectively in higher education, what are we doing to build the kind of, to go at that bending the cost curve that I spoke of? What are the kind of efficiencies? What are the kind of associations and consortial work? What can we do to bring the great quality education in both the independent and public sectors at a price point that's possible for families? So we have work to do. I don't point this all at policymakers. I think higher education itself has a responsibility to do that.
One of the things that Governor Cuomo has talked about is free public tuition, and he's a believer, and certain members of the legislature are. And yet, when this proposal kind of rolled out in recent months, we heard from some of your colleagues at private schools, like Don Braveman at Nazareth, for just one example, saying, look, this proposal not only isn't all that much of the benefit that it might be sort of dressed up to be for lower income students, but we're not even sure public schools have the infrastructure for a big increase in students, and what would that mean for private schools? In other words, you know, maybe some thought it was self-serving, but he said, honestly, in his view, it was the wrong way to go. How did you view it?
Well, I've heard that argument. I've heard, you know, we've all probably read David Brooks's piece looking at other ways of investment. Those are all interesting public policy. To the broader point of making college more accessible, I am certainly for that. You know, I think one would have to appreciate also as a matter of public policy that the independent sector, the independent colleges in New York, educate nearly 30% of all New Yorkers, which is a very significant number. And the percentage of state aid nowhere matches that kind of commitment. So we are fueled by philanthropy, or fueled by investments of families and graduates. And so into this mosaic that I speak of, into this collective, one has to grant and observe the critical role that independent colleges and universities, as in Rochester, as in here in Geneva, perform for the workforce, for the benefit of society. So it would be unfortunate if it turned on that kind of, given the broader issues that exist in higher education, if it pitted sectors in that way. I am proud that independent schools are educating 30% of New Yorkers. I'm proud of the work that our public colleagues do as well. And I would hope that policymakers would look to ways where the independent sector that is largely fueled and engaged by our philanthropy has a match, or if not literally a match, then has an appreciation for that critical role. Because in many institutions and in many smaller communities, smaller regional institutions, they are big drivers to the economy, those independent colleges.
So I want to make sure I fully understand your position then. Not a fan of this proposal. Shorten it for me.
Well, I won't shorten it for you because I think it needs, and that's why this show is so good, that
okay,
we don't want to
fair.
Answer a bumper sticker with a bumper sticker.
Okay, no, that's
right.
Fair. That's
and
fair.
So I think the opportunity we have, I would hope, in conversations like this, is to really engage much more threaded conversations.
It does sound like you're worried about deleterious effects of a well-intended policy.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
Okay.
I mean, and an appreciation for what the independent sector is doing, as I would hope I have voiced an appreciation for the public sector. We're all in this together. We're all trying to provide ladders of opportunity for American higher education. There is a scale and a spectrum of ways, very good ways, one can get educated in this country. I think as we pit these sectors, that is unfortunate.
Okay. We're talking to Mark Guerin, the president of Hobart and William Smith Colleges, for another 5 weeks or so.
Then he's
off to Harvard to become a president in residence there, starting in the fall. And he's been at Hobart and William Smith Colleges since 1999. But of course, Mark has an illustrious career serving in working in politics, and then, of course, appointed to be the director of the Peace Corps, has a closeness with the Clintons for the work that you have done. So I don't want to sidetrack the entire hour on politics, but I do enjoy talking politics with you. And I do want to ask you, you know, sort of how you feel at this political moment. It was an extraordinary moment yesterday watching Jim Comey's testimony. To date myself a little, I was saying, I can't remember if there's another time between Comey yesterday and the time I remember as a kid going, click, 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 every channel is Oliver North, every channel was Jim Comey yesterday. It was pretty extraordinary to see. How are you feeling about what you're seeing on the national?
No, you're absolutely right. And I was thinking of it as well, because I can't remember a hearing of that import where I could live stream it right to my desk or to my phone, no matter what I was doing yesterday, right? North, other hearings.
Yeah, right.
We didn't have the facility.
We were locked into. Yeah.
Now, for better or worse, we could have it wherever we were going yesterday. It was a notable moment. There's no question. I was struck. I think it was Dana Milbank today in the Washington Post took out one of the quotes from Director Comey talking about, I think it was the nature of the person.
Yeah,
is how Comey. So these are sobering times. I take comfort as a citizen that there are equally invested branches of government that have responsibilities and so forth. The founding fathers were genius in their creation in doing this. And, you know, hopefully as issues need to be vetted out, that will be attended to. Broadly, though, we've never been in a time, and it's just I just finished Friedman's book, Thank You for Being Late, and he makes the point of just the sheer velocity of change as technology has fueled it. The iPhone is only 10 years old. So when I think back on my service in a White House in 1995, from 92 to 95, it just seems like a very different era. It's like describing that I worked for Millard Fillmore or something instead of Bill Clinton, right? In terms of the sheer velocity of change, the speed of information transacted, how we get our information, the echo chambers that exist between Fox and MSNBC, and everyone hovers in their own echo chamber to affirm or their viewpoint. So all of those threaded issues make our politics today much more complicated, and therefore much more important, I would argue, that we all stay engaged, because it's easy for some, and we've all heard it enough, for people saying, I can't watch it anymore, I can't watch the news, I'm overwhelmed, or whatever. And that is concerning, because I think we need a engaged citizenry at every level and at every point in our country's history.
I understand the passion that's out there, but I also am a little worried about the way that maybe it just feels like this right now, and maybe historically it's always been this way, but it feels that it's very hard to disagree in ways that don't become really tribal. You know, in 1976, Carter wins the presidency, and 27% of American counties were what we call landslide counties, so 20 points or more for the winner in that county. So 27% landslide counties in 1976. 2004, Bush beats Kerry, and 48% of American counties were landslide counties. And last year, 60% of American counties. So we've really, really moved in ways where you're not very likely to know too many people on your street or even in your town or your area who might disagree with you. We're kind of retreating in that way. Mm-hmm. Well, you have this well-publicized college roommate and friendship with Hugh Hewitt, who is of a different political stripe, or at least...
Misguided, yes.
Misguided. Hugh's a, if you don't know Hugh Hewitt, a longtime columnist for Town Hall and a talk show host and a very skilled guy, very smart guy, very much a mover and a shaker in terms of shaping opinion on the conservative side. But he
Washington
always speaks...
Post columnist now.
But he always speaks very highly of you, and I think I've heard you do the same. How do we get to where... We do have friends who are different.
Well,
or get back there.
No, it's a really fair point, Evan, and it's fascinating to me because he's when I've taught courses here and I've had him call in or engage, and students are aware that we were college roommates, and to this day, very good friends and godparents away, you know, the usual college friends. And when you explain this friendship and say, "Well, my college roommate and very close friend to this day is a right-wing talk show host. He did the presidential debate." Well. Students today, it's fascinating to me. It was not particularly eventful for us in college. He was president of the Harvard Republican Club when we were undergraduates, and I was not. But that wasn't relevant. It was relevant. It was just a series of debate. Grover Norquist was in our house. Our tutor was Alan Keyes. And that all added a vibrancy to the conversations. When I engage with our students today, here or at other places, and it's asked or observed, it's surprising and shocking to people. Now that, I think, is a little revealing to the broader point you're making of this balkanization of news, and not just news, but of views and how we retreat to that. Some of it, I think, is exacerbated by the splintered, decentralized media and echo chambers that exist, not all of it. Some of it is organized into the gerrymandered districts that affirm, and some of them for good reasons and intentionally intended to create more diversity within the Congress and historically black districts. I mean, originally out of some good intent in some areas, but have this kind of locked in dimension. And so then your result is a Congress that doesn't turn over very often, and it's so very staid and only challenged from a poll of the incumbent's party. That is a very different electoral ethic and culture than I think the founders intended, or probably that we had 30 years ago.
We have some criticism that comes from people like Hugh Hewitt. In fact, he's weighed in on this issue. A lot of conservatives feel this way, but not this is not the sole domain of conservatives, complaining about the temperature on college campuses when it comes to student engagement, whether they're going to welcome other points of view. Are those criticisms that we're hearing fair, Mark?
Yes. Yeah. You know, I think college campuses should be places where, particularly at that age in one's life, of traditional age students anyway, but even just within society as centers of learning for the community and others, where voices are allowed to engage in discourse. Now, there are some examples of voices out there that are, it's more entertainment than serious conversations. So I'm suggesting that in terms of serious even partisan voices of difference is a very good thing for students. It was a very good thing for me as an undergraduate to have a roommate that we would argue issues so that when I then wound up at the White House as a young staffer, I never have agreed with you on much. We haven't convinced each other of much in the ensuing years. Did not have the feeling of quite demonizing the opposition, I would hope, to an unhealthy place. And I would like to think the same would be the case for him. That, in our little small example, I think is a broader issue we have. When you don't know people, no matter what the difference is, it is either to cartoon someone or to demonize someone. And so the opportunity, I believe, in college campuses that we have, the privilege we have in an environment like this of academic freedom, of free and open discourse of ideas, is that our students will leave with that enhanced perspective. So no matter where they go or wherever they live, to have the opportunity to bring that to our citizenship. So we're at an interesting inflection point, and there have been some pretty high profile examples, college and university campuses in recent years. But I would hope that we can have a pivot point or an opportunity that respectful dialogue, full with the kind of disagreement and engagement that should mark campuses. Because when you look at major changes in society in our country's history, from anti-war efforts to increased environmental responsibilities, college campuses have been really influential voices in that. And you don't want to in any way diminish that activism, that sense of purpose, particularly if they're traditional age college students forming their views, going out into adulthood. So I see so much of the progress in the United States as having started on college and university campuses. We just hosted our reunions here at Hobart and William Smith, and talking particularly to the 45th reunioners from the class of 1972 was fascinating. When they arrived here in Geneva, New York in 1968, traditional rules, parietals for women, a very traditional space in 1968. By the time they left in 1972, given all the tumult of the war and other social issues, a very changed place. So it's fascinating to think, and history is a helpful guide to remind one that while issues of today may seem vexing and challenging, and they certainly are, and complex, history is also helpful and a reminder to know that we've navigated interesting shoals in American history and certainly American higher education.
I gave a presentation recently on sort of evolution of the media and the role of journalists today at Osher Learning Center at RIT. And after the presentation, some of the audience members came up and we were chatting, and they said, look, you know, we're self-identified liberals, but you mentioned the importance of not just consuming media that could kind of confirm your biases and, you know, motivated reasoning. So give us some examples of conservatives in media who we should be reading. And I said, okay, great. Here's a list. And I mentioned a few names and they said, why have we never heard of them? Well, how come I've never heard of Raihan Salam? How come I've never heard? And I said, because we're in this media moment where kind of the clowns, the Sean Hannitys of the world, are making the millions of dollars and have the loudest voices. And I don't know how to get back to a point where, because then I look at college campuses and most of the tumult comes when a Milo comes,
right,
an Ann Coulter. These people are not serious intellectuals or not serious thinkers. I'm not saying we should shut them out. I'm not saying we should march and not allow them to speak, but I'd love to see campuses say, let's bring in some of the real conservative intellectuals, of which there are plenty. But of course, the Milos and the Ann Coulters get the, you know, then of course, Charles Murray goes to Metterboy. You have those issues as well. So it's not just the Milos and the Ann Coulters, but how do we get back to a point where we are, you know, the intellectuals on all sides are the ones who are celebrated, read more, get more attention, maybe even make more money. And college campuses are inviting the intellectuals and not just the sexy voices that sell a lot of books and have a lot of headlines.
Well, I think it's incumbent upon us who care about open and free exchange of ideas to invite them and to the responsibility, like you cited, and to have conversations like you fortunately host for all of us in the region here, where there's a broad and engaging sense of the issues. Look, knowledge is power. And for people to really have kind of access to ideas and to put ideas into action will require that diversity of opinion. So I feel like we're at a turning point, candidly. I think there have been these high-profile, tumultuous examples where I think people have been reminded of the salience and importance of providing open access to a broad range of ideas.
We're talking to Mark Guerin from Hobart and William Smith Colleges. He's getting ready to move on to Harvard in the fall, and he is finishing up his tenure here. He'll be done in the middle of July, and we're broadcasting live. Why do I say live when we're on the road? Every show is just about live. It just feels different when you're on the road. We were at the Little Theater last week, and today we're here in Geneva at our studios at WEOS and our wonderful partners and colleagues at Finger Lakes Public Radio. If you want to call the program with comments or questions, you can do so toll-free, 844-295-TALK. That's 844-295-8255. You can email the program. Just email me, edawson@wxxi.org or connections@wxxi.org. So much more to discuss. So let's get our only break of the hour and come back with President Guerin here on Connections. Coming up in our second hour as we continue broadcasting from our WEOS studios in Geneva, we'll talk about grassroots organizing and citizen involvement. There's been a lot of talk since last fall about more people wanting to get involved all across this country in various causes. Geneva is a place where that has been happening for a long time, and we'll learn what they've been doing, what these organizations, Tools for Social Change, and the Geneva Women's Assembly have been accomplishing in the local community. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson, and Mark Guerin came to Hobart and William Smith in 1999. Had you been to the Finger Lakes in your life before coming
out? I had. I'd been into Rochester, Syracuse, and Ithaca, but never to beautiful Geneva.
And what is the biggest difference at HWS today versus the day you started?
Well, I'd like to think that people would have an enhanced sense of confidence for this place. It has always been a wonderful institution, having known graduates through the years. So confidence in the sense of the possibilities that exist for our students, because it's boundless for them. And I think through strategic plans and efforts that really take the power of the collective, our board, faculty, staff, alums, students, with time and effort and purpose, that you can make the kind of changes that make this a better place. So I'm excited about that and really excited for the future. We have a great new president coming in, Greg Vincent, long experience in higher education. He's a Hobart graduate, so as an alumnus coming in, this is the first time that's ever happened here in almost two centuries. So that's a big deal. And it's a wonderful choice.
We got an email from a listener named Tina who just wants to know, says, Evan, I know your guest worked for President Clinton. Does he think there's a chance Hillary Clinton will run again for president? Does he have any insight there?
I have no inside information. I would doubt it. I think her opportunities to serve in lots of different ways and her voice can be particularly appreciated at this time. But I wouldn't look to another electoral opportunity.
Do you get the sense though that the Democratic Party has an actual, you know, a Clinton wing and a Sanders wing, and does it have to reconcile either 2018 if they want to win the midterms, but especially if they want to win the White House in 2020?
Oh, I think every party has wings and has always had that. So I don't think this is particularly new. It's new in the sense of the names, perhaps Sanders and Clinton. But there's always been a spectrum within at least the Democratic Party, and that's a healthy thing. And so I think over the next, from the midterms and then running up to 2020, there'll be, you know, the value of extended primaries and opportunities and debates to do that. 91 and 92 provided Bill Clinton that. The third way that he spoke of, all of that was a different way to think of the Democratic Party. I had worked on Michael Dukakis' campaign. And then the Clinton campaign. So the wings, so-called wings or spectrums, and particularly after a tough primary, is not surprising to me. One could argue it's a healthy thing because people are engaged and still committed for the kind of changes that the party espouses. So I don't find it eventful, as I see within the Republican Party, historically, wings and various viewpoints.
Well, I've said, I think you're a very wise and astute political observer. You've worked very closely with it. So let me just take me back a little bit here. You worked on the Dukakis campaign in 88. Why do you think he lost? It wasn't just the wearing the helmet thing, was it?
Let's hope not. Although that didn't help.
Yeah.
let's just be
optics
honest.
Optics do make
optics
an impact.
Optics matter. Yeah. I think there are several things I think he would say because he's been here on campus and lectured in my class. The debate, it was not his finest hour with the classic Bernard Shaw question.
Even though I thought his answer was unfairly pilloried.
Right. But that the nature of debates are like that. One thing can take off.
By the way, if you're not remembering what Mark's talking about, it was a question on how he would have responded if, was it Kitty were murdered?
Correct.
If Kitty were murdered, talking about the death penalty.
We're raped.
Mm. Talking about, you know, punishment. And he gave a very dispassionate, clinical answer where people wanted to see him say, I'd be furious. I'd want to tear the offender limb from limb. And he didn't do that.
No.
And I actually think, look at the difference between the last president and the current president. Sometimes a cool, collected, dispassionate hand has a real value, particularly in crisis, but that was viewed as a real negative.
It was. It just was seen, as you rightly observed, as kind of dispassionate. And I was there, and I can remember going into the press room.
Did you know right when that you gave that answer that you were in trouble?
We had a sense that we weren't ascending. I walked into the press room the next morning, and Sam Donaldson was on our plane covering the campaign. He said, well, Mark, it's the Bataan death march to the end now. So that was our warning. So there was that. I think the other piece is, you know, look, the other campaign ran a really good campaign. You can argue on its negativity or observe the Willie Horton ads or the way it was conducted, but Lee Atwater, the late Lee Atwater, was a strategist of real skill. And so as we had our deficiencies on our campaign, and while I admire the governor's reluctance to take that on and to kind of respond in kind, I think every Democrat, including Michael Dukakis, would say after that defeat that you have to fight back. And hence the vaunted war room in the 92 campaign was a lesson learned. And I think for all succeeding campaigns, Republican or Democrat, the Trump White House is talking about setting up a war room right now. So I think in the modern age, particularly, but even back to 88, when there really were just three networks plus CNN, it's still that sense of responding, quick response, getting in the news cycle, and so forth, that was not Governor Dukakis's penchant to do that. And he had a different sense of how to run his presidential campaign, which has laudatory aspects in terms of kind of the civic dimension of that. But it put us in an electoral deficit.
Of course, you had the war room in 91, 92, but you also had one of the most skilled political operators this country has ever seen. And listeners who may be on any part of the political spectrum, that's not endorsing Bill Clinton one way or another. That's just an observation, just a remarkable politician, a gift with people. And now what the party has seen was Hillary Clinton, Bernie Sanders, and this, one of the things you often hear these days is, well, people don't care about the pizzazz anymore. They want authenticity. I don't know why they felt like they got it in Donald Trump, because he's changed his position so often, and it's strange to me. But for the Democratic Party, looking at 2020, you know, it's one thing to reconcile a so-called Clinton wing and a Sanders wing. It's another to say, what do you think the voters actually want? Do they want pragmatism and to win? Do they want purity tests? Do they want real ideology that reflects values? I mean, what's the combination?
Yeah, I think it is a combination. And then it will so hinge on the field. And that's what's interesting about politics. I mean, if we had sat here 3 years ago and said, okay, Evan, here's what's going to happen. Donald Trump will be the president. And a 72-year-old socialist senator from Vermont, not a member of the Democratic Party, will give Mrs. Clinton, Secretary Clinton, a serious run for... I mean, you wouldn't have necessarily predicted that, no. Right? And so it's always interesting to me when you're looking and forecasting on into electoral cycles, because you can't beat someone with no one. But we don't know yet who it is. I have the sense, honestly, that it's a moment where, because of President Trump's never having held office, because President Obama was in the U.S. Senate for a relatively brief time, that I think it will open up the optics for candidates, perhaps from the House, mayors. I don't think we're just driven necessarily and exclusively to governors and senators anymore. I think there's a whole opening. You look at Mark Zuckerberg, Mark Cuban. I mean, there's a very interesting
The Rock. Everybody thinks they can. That's one thing. The Donald Trump effect is these people in outside of politics feel like the door's wide open.
Right. Well, there's a lot of talk about Evan Dawson.
There's no talk about that. I've heard nothing about that.
You just did. Yeah. I'm starting a movement.
Yeah. Okay. Flattery will get you nowhere, Mark. And by the way, that would be torture for me. Tom on Twitter wants to know, can you ask Mark, how has Trump earned a free pass on behavior, lying, boundaries, etc.?
What a great question. Well, I'm not sure that he has. I mean, you know, there's, when you look at favorability ratings and so forth, and the president's position at this point in an initial beginning administration, I think it shows some of the effects of that. There's something about the sheer volume of activity that's going on, that even for those of us that are junkies of the news, it's hard to keep track of all this. Don't you feel that way?
Yeah.
I mean, it's sort of really
for
hard.
Sure.
I mean, look at the British election. Would have been a significant, and it is a significant, so he's leading all the papers, but there have been so many examples in the past couple of months where other stories would have had very significant prominence, but for the activity in Washington. And so the sheer volume of all of that has sort of this numbing effect in some ways.
I would just say to Tom, you know, my observation, and this isn't just mine, I mean, this is kind of culled from people smarter than me who've been observing this, especially for the last year, is to the extent that other politicians have had scandals, it's often one scandal, and the media can hone in on it. It was Monica Lewinsky. We can focus on Monica Lewinsky. It was, you know, Nixon scandal, Watergate. You can focus in on that. Donald Trump says things almost on a daily basis that might be scandalous for another politician in a different context. I mean, I remember when John McCain, when he talked about John McCain and during the campaign, and everyone said, well, it's over for him. You can't criticize a war hero. The Republican Party will not stand for somebody criticizing a POW. It made no dent, partially because one of the ideas is there's so many things in the air. If you're skeet shooting, you aim at the skeet. What if they send 50 targets up? You're paralyzed. You don't know what to shoot at. And the next thing you know, they've all passed.
Yep.
So I think that there's something to that.
It's the volume of all of
this. Yeah, it's remarkable. And that is what's different, I think, about this one. It's so difficult to sit here and be like, well, you haven't released your taxes. Do we care about that? Trump University. Look at all the people who got, but we're on to the next one. We don't have time for it.
But I think it's not just, I think if we're candid, there's also skill that comes with that capacity to do that.
Skill on the behalf of Trump.
Correct. And to blow by it, to rise above it, to keep, I mean, we may have views on that and frustration with that, but it's there.
We're talking to Hobart and William Smith College's president, Mark Guerin, who has been in this role since 1999. 5 weeks from now, he is done here, and he heads off in the fall to Harvard. He will be president in residence and working on issues related to higher education there. On Twitter, Mike says, I'm sorry your guests can preach tolerance in conversation, but what is there to discuss with people who do not believe in science, are misogynistic, don't care about the environment, and are flat-out racist by their actions in law and regulation?
Yeah, no, I hear you. It's but that's the opportunity that we have. Look, I'm the house optimist here. And I would like to think that the power of knowledge, the power of knowledge creation, the role of colleges and universities in this country, where it will require eternal vigilance in this regard, it can be frustrating and so forth. I certainly hear that in the listener's question. But I do think there's responsibility. Shows like this certainly scholarship with our faculty, columnists, other views, to make certain of some things that are certain, like some of the science questions, like some of the questions of the importance of diversity. But it is a time where everyone has an easy microphone, easy reporting, easy tweet, and that changes it, because it brings in, sadly, stark relief. The views that are odious, or the ones that we disagree with.
Sure, and I always lean toward the side of airing things out anyway, and then sometimes trying to get at the root of why certain beliefs form. A good example is just the other day, a nice listener, very nice woman, she seems to be, called from Ithaca, and was complaining that the guests we had who were talking about autism were dismissive of her belief that Andy Wakefield is absolutely correct and that vaccines cause autism, which has been discredited repeatedly in the medical community by science. And all I wanted to do was sort of air out, well, let's talk about what are the books you've read? You know, what are the sources of information? Why do you believe this way? I didn't want to mock or attack, but I had listeners saying, you can't air that phone call. That's dangerous. And I did say, look, what she's saying has been discredited by science, but doesn't have any currency in terms of actual fact. But I want to understand why people believe what they believe, because ultimately, if we want to make any movement, I think we have to at least try to understand where beliefs come from, how they form. So for the most part, I err on the side of hearing it. Whereas I think some people, maybe Mike included or others, would say, well, stop attacking college students for they don't want to hear this because they're only being intolerant to intolerance and those kinds of things. What do you say?
Right. And I think we're in sort of a transition time. We don't quite know. I mean, both sides are complaining about fake news. You hear this every day, right?
That's that term, though, has just been co-opted.
Of course,
so it
right.
means nothing,
right? Yeah. But it's out there, but it's an insidious thing. So it leaves you questioning an awful lot. And it was interesting this week. We had a celebration of staff recognition, and there was a colleague. We gave out different length of service awards. She's been working here at Hobart and William Smith in our library for 40 years. It's a wonderful statement. She's given her career to this place. And over the arc of that 40 years, has had to go from the Dewey Decimal System to a highly technological, I mean, she has prepared herself, changed, and it's a great, wonderful testament to the great kind of people we have here at Hobart and William Smith. But it occurred to me that, you know, libraries, increasingly, when they were written off 10 years ago and everyone was wondering about the future of libraries, we're into this complex, convoluted, fake news charged environment that we operate in. Where will we look for the kind of truth and the validation of sourcing? Where will that be? Not everyone can listen to Connections every day. Where are we going on this? And I think libraries have a whole new frontier of knowledge as guardians of knowledge and as arbiters of fake and credentialed.
Talking to Mark Guerin for another 10 minutes or so, president of Hobart and William Smith Colleges. And I want to ask you about I want to get back to higher education on a couple of issues. Malcolm Gladwell has a podcast series that's actually coming back next week for season two called Revisionist History. And I have a lot of admiration for Gladwell. I also have some issues with how he is a little too reductive. And in fact, Mark's admonishing me earlier not to distill to bumper stickers recalls my disdain for how Gladwell sometimes done that. So the point was well taken. But he spent a lot of time attacking sticker prices and the cost of higher ed. And one of the points he wanted to make clear to his listeners was that he thinks the evidence shows if you're giving money, particularly big gifts, Phil Knight giving $400 million to Stanford, that there's not an ROI on that that compares to giving that kind of gift to a state school, a public school, a small school, a school that's trying to grow, that can serve more people, and that philanthropy, which is important for Hobart and William Smith, Gladwell argues philanthropy to private schools is not a good investment. I assume you would think that that's wrong, yeah. But why do you think that's wrong?
Well, I think it's wrong, and I can speak to knowledgeably to Hobart and William Smith, because I've seen it. I've seen it for 18 years. I've seen it both in terms of physical space, that if someone reaches back over the history of their lives to support academic space or technology-enriched space, lives are changed. Doors are open. Opportunities are there in the classroom or physical space or athletic facilities, all that comes. Or significantly with scholarship for financial aid, for all the reasons I started with. You know, it's a very frequent question for a college president at alum gatherings. They'll say, well, what keeps you up at night, right? So the bad joke, of course, is, well, I live next to a fraternity, right? But the serious answer is, as we started our conversation, Evan, with, is access. But I have seen, because I've now, over the time of 18 years, known donors that have been generous with us, supported financial aid. And then, because it's 2,200 students here, I know so many of the students. I will know the individual who's receiving that, and frequently their backstory. And there is no question in my mind that their lives are transformed. So I don't buy it. We have this wonderful effort here in Geneva, Geneva Scholarship Associates, that over 40 years has built an endowment of almost $2 million, $1.9 million. Understand, these are Geneva citizens, not graduates by and large, raising money to support Geneva kids, sometimes their children, most not, to come to Hobart and William Smith. This doesn't happen in many places. So we just gave out the three individual scholarships, and they were there. Their accomplishments, their service work, their academic profile, their leadership, athletic accomplishments. And I know those families because my daughter's in their class, senior in class, in the high school. We know from the narrative of American history the progress to families, to communities, with the power of education. At an independent institution like this, but for that access, but for that scholarship, that was created in Geneva or endowed funds here at Hobart and William Smith, those lives would not be transformed. We just had reunions here, every 5 years coming back. They will come back and reflect on their time here, the lives they've lived, particularly first-generation students. We think of it in today's terms of first-generation, but many having been out 50 years, 45 years, who will reflect on the opportunities they had for themselves, their families. So private philanthropy is consequential. And in a place like this, it's well spent, it's well stewarded, and it is transformational to students and then their families.
Let's grab a phone call, and we'll take John in Rochester, who's on the line with President Mark Guerin. Go ahead, John. I think we've got John. Let's see if we can hear him. Maybe we're not transferring the sound, because I can't hear him if he's talking. why don't you hang there? We'll see if we can get him back. They'll let us know. Because we're, by the way, we're broadcasting from WUS in Geneva. So it's our first phone call we're trying to take. And we're going to swing and miss once in a while, but we'll figure. So John, hang there. We'll see if we can get you back on.
Can you hear me?
Oh, there you are.
Okay,
we got you.
Great.
Mark, can you hear him?
I can hear you.
Okay, go ahead, John.
Hi, Mark. Mark, you know, I'm speaking to the source here. I heard some conservative talk people and in print, conservative print, that said that when you were involved with the Bush Gore challenge, I guess, down in Florida, they had printed and talked about you trying to disqualify military votes. Is that true?
Wow, that's a new one on me.
Okay.
And the Bush Gore election, I was
overseas military absentee.
Oh, that's even more ornate. No, I was happily ensconced here at Hobart and William Smith. I was appointed in 1999. I did not travel to Florida for the election. So no, that's
fake news.
Well, it's even beyond that. It's inaccurate.
Okay.
But I appreciate the chance. No, I appreciate the chance to correct the record.
Thank you, John. Okay. We appreciate that phone call. And Mark always appreciates the chance to clear the air on that. Got a few more minutes, and let me just hit the question on jobs. One of the things we've talked about with outgoing college students, recently minted graduates, is whether they're finding jobs in our region. And you mentioned earlier this hour something I think is important. It's understandable for families to look at ROI when you look at loan debt. You understand why, you know, parents might be saying, what's your major going to be? What are the average salaries? When do we pay off the loan debt? Maybe even more so than they used to. We've got more than $1 trillion, I think, of loan debt in this country. So I understand that. Mark made the point, if you missed it earlier this hour, that it's important that students are not just looking at the bigger salaries out there, but to say, if I want to be a teacher, if I want to work in service, that I'm going to pursue that path. And part of that is making sure that they're not going to be so burdened with loan debt that they would ignore that opportunity. Well, when it comes right now to the most popular majors, I don't know what they are at HWS in terms of how that hierarchy goes, but how do you feel about, you know, job opportunity? I'm sure parents bring that up all the time.
Oh, absolutely.
Are we going to get work? So kind of just give me in the last couple minutes here, push and pull on how
Look, it's a fair question, you know, particularly in independent education where the price can be formidable for families. So we take it very seriously. So we have a very important career services effort, a guaranteed internship for our students that go through our Pathways program, working to engage alums. So by the time our students graduate, they've come through the Pathways program, have the opportunity for internships to explore in an experiential education context, workshops on resume writing, interview intake, all that's incumbent upon that. Because while we believe a liberal arts education is the best preparation for the 21st century, because they will change jobs many times. So narrowly construed fields may seem satisfying, and for some it may be, right, for so many people, the fields that they will study, most of the jobs that they will have, do not even exist today in the 21st century economy. So a broad education with writing, communications, analytical thinking, all that's imbued in a liberal arts education is a very robust preparation for this century that they will live and work in, assuming that it's also tethered to a very aggressive career services assist to them while they're here. So our students, we're proud. When I looked out at the graduating class, we had students going on to graduate school, Brown Medical School, and law schools and business schools, many going into work from Wall Street to a rich array of areas. Service components, 4 or 5 going into the Peace Corps to teach for America. We're one of the top producers of Fulbright scholars. So the past 2 years, 7 Fulbright scholars. So really good preparation. There's no question of it. But we want to ensure that debt, and we monitor it closely, that it doesn't shackle them to career decisions, to life choices that will not serve the broader society well.
I'm looking at the clock, 20 seconds. What are you going to miss most?
I'll miss our students, engaging with students. We've had the privilege of living on campus. My wife has hosted an open house every Friday at our home, going to games, plays, performing arts. We have dazzling students here. I'll miss that.
Well, I really appreciate the time. Every time we've called, you've said we're going to work it out. And we appreciate the access and the chance to talk to you. I know the community does as well. Good luck to you at Harvard.
Thank you.
And thank you for being here. And
thank you for what you're
doing.
Thank you for engaging the community in these ways.
You got it. That's HWS outgoing president Mark Guerin joining us for the hour. We're broadcasting from WUS Finger Lakes Public Radio. And we're going to stay here for the next hour. So stay right here and more connections straight ahead.